Well, the world is a dumpster fire. Nothing here makes sense. And you vacillate between crippling fear and constant self-defense. And nothing's right and nothing's good. And you're paralyzed with grief. Don't kill yourself, just have a cup of coffee.
Welcome to Coffee Over Suicide, the dramedy podcast about mental illness and choosing life over death, one cup of coffee at a time. I'm your host, Chris Parker Howard. And as of tomorrow, this podcast will be officially 1 year old. I officially launched this thing in July of 2018. And a lot of things have happened. I've got a studio built. I've got better equipment. I know how to record an episode now. Kind of regret some of the early ones where the sound quality was, let's say, less than awesome. And I've grown a little bit as a person. I've learned to be more centered and more calm and more mindful. And I've been forced to recognize that fact. A lot, especially today. Now, why today? What about today is particularly taxing for me that I feel like I've handled like a champ? Well, here's the thing. I can talk about it now because by the time this airs, this will have already happened. You see, my band, Decatur, got contacted by a sports team. I guess I'll leave their name out of it for now. You can look this up. And we got contacted to perform an original arrangement of the national anthem at Broncos Stadium on the 4th of July. And we thought, wow, that's pretty cool. That's a really big thing to do. And we're so stoked that they asked us. Yeah, we'll put together an arrangement. And so we put together an arrangement that we were real happy with. We worked on it real hard. And then come today, July 3rd, it's chaos because they weren't prepared for a full band. Through all the conversations about a full band, they weren't prepared for it. Now, it was really just a matter of a person not really understanding logistics and it was a mistake for sure, but it was not anything that was, vindictive, and everybody was very cool about saying, look, you know, this is going to present a huge problem. And so, essentially we cannot move forward with this. So you've got to change your plans. I don't handle change of plans very well. At least I didn't used to. I was kind of thinking about it today, you know, the meeting this level of resistance over something, meeting this level of chaos and panic, I think I would have tore my hair out and I would have been a problem. But today I just kind of said, okay, this is what it is. So now what? How do we make this work? How do we work this out? And I'm not going to lie, it was a little stressful. I'm still a little stressed out. I actually don't know, even as of this recording, what we're doing tomorrow. I don't know if I'm playing drums. I don't know if I'm going to be sitting at home because it didn't happen. But instead of being angry, I allowed myself to feel a little disappointed. And I'm moving past it. I got so many other things to be grateful for. There's another opportunity for greatness and gratefulness right around the corner. There always is. And I'm pretty glad about that. Today on the show, we have got Carla Houghton, who is the singer and songwriter, co-songwriter for the Midnight Marionettes, a goth rock electronic industrial kind of duo from right here in Colorado. And we have a really awesome conversation about blazing your own path toward comfortability within your own skin. And I think you're going to love it. Let's talk to Carla. There's headphones if you want them, and there's no headphones if you don't.
Okay.
So, hi. How's it going?
Hi. I'm good.
Excellent. So, you were saying that when we were getting coffee that you had just come from therapy.
Yeah.
Yeah. How long have you been seeing your therapist?
I just started seeing this therapist earlier this year.
Mm-hmm.
So, she's a new one. I had a really great therapist that moved to be closer to her grandchildren in another state. And then, unfortunately, as a teacher, I have to go through Kaiser.
Which, yeah.
No offense, but I really don't like Kaiser. So I got a therapist through Kaiser, and she was really sweet.
Mm-hmm.
But one day I was like really depressed, and she just got up and screamed at me and literally yelled and said, "Your dad is not why you are depressed." And I froze. And I said, "We're done here."
Mom?
So, like, what is going on? Like, who says that to someone?
Yeah. You know, it's amazing the number of therapists out there that are not qualified.
Yeah.
It's really astounding because it takes a lot of work to get to that point. But I feel like there are, like any other profession out there.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to get some lemons.
Yeah, and I completely understood. Like, she seemed like she was kind of, you know, at her breaking point of, like, that vicarious trauma that you take on.
Yeah.
If you are a therapist. I could kind of tell she wasn't having a good day, you know, but I was like, well. And then she just yelled that at me. And so for a while, I was like, maybe I don't need a therapist. Maybe I should just, you know, read books and meditate and try to help myself.
Yeah.
And then after like 6 months, I started having, you know, really intense depression and suicidal ideations and was in a really bad way. And I was like, I have to have a therapist. So I called Kaiser and I told them what happened, and I felt really bad to like kind of out this therapist.
Right.
But it was like starting to take a toll. It was like a life or death situation. So
they referred. But in a way, it seems like you would have to out a therapist like that because,
yeah.
I mean, even if she's just going through something at the moment, the trouble with something like that is that letting someone like that continue to see patients is dangerous because that kind of advice where it's like, you know, essentially screaming at you, your problems are not your problems.
Yeah.
You know, that doesn't seem like it'd be very helpful.
No, it wasn't very helpful
at
all. So then I found my current therapist, and she's really great. She's very insightful and calm, and the whole energy at her office is really calming. So I was really lucky to find her.
Yeah, I like my lady too. She's a lot like me, and will. So of course I like her.
Yeah,
but you know, she gets kind of scatterbrained and flighty and excitable.
Mm-hmm.
But I love all of that, and I feel like we connect, and that matters.
Mm-hmm.
So when I talk to her and I tell her about something that I'm going through, I don't really need a lot of feedback because I understand that, for one, I don't have to explain it much deeper because she understands,
mm-hmm.
and for two, she'll hit me with a couple of words that are enough insight for me to get what I need. Like, oh, yeah, because I've done years and years of work.
Mm-hmm.
What about you? Like, when did you first discover, you know, your dark pal?
Yeah. I think I kind of always was a little too much obsessed with death and a little bit sad.
Yeah.
And when I was 13, I finally asked my mom. I said, I need to talk to somebody who's a professional. I actually met an amazing woman, my young adult librarian at the local library. I grew up in Moore, Oklahoma, which is a really small town in Oklahoma.
Nice.
Yeah. It's the one that gets the giant tornadoes that gets eaten like every 10 years by like F5s. But anyway, so she kind of took me under her wing. It was funny. She was 27 and I was 13 and we both thought each other were 18.
Yeah.
And so we became like fast friends, and she also struggled with mental health and mental illness. And she said, you know, you're not alone. And this isn't just something you can't talk about, because when you grow up in like the Bible Belt,
yeah,
you're supposed to keep that quiet. Like that's not something it's okay to feel.
Yeah.
Because, you know, just pray and it'll be over with, Carla Ann, just do that. And,
sure.
And that's not, that didn't work. So around that same time, I stopped believing in Christianity, and that like, it just kind of was like the floor dropped out. Like I realized like the very tumultuous childhood I had, which was very hard. And then I stopped believing in God and kind of everything happened at once. So
it's like, this is bullshit, but I don't have a replacement.
Yeah. Yeah. It wasn't until I was like 19 that I found my path of being pagan.
Yeah.
So for a long time I was more agnostic, but when you live in Moore, Oklahoma, and you say, I don't believe in God or Jesus Christ, it's like, you are Satan. People hate you. Like, it's not okay. So it was a lot of like soul searching, and at the same time, like I was, you know, discovering different kinds of music. But my mom did finally take me to a therapist, and that was really helpful. And then my parents got divorced when I was 16, and we moved to Colorado. Mm-hmm. And I got a really good therapist who did a lot of EMDR with me, and that helped me to be able to forgive my father. Because that was kind of the.
Was the divorce crux. Particularly difficult, or?
I was happy.
Yeah.
Because my parents fought
so
a
this
lot.
Was, yeah. So this was a good one. Like,
yeah. Like, yeah, I was
thank God
super
they got
happy.
Divorced.
Yeah. I was like, yay. That's not a normal reaction, probably, but I was really happy. And we moved to Colorado, and I felt a lot more like I'm with my tribe here in Colorado. Like, people are a lot more open minded.
Yeah.
And not so, you know, conservative, Christian. Cookie cutter.
Well, like if you want that, you can go to the Springs.
Yeah, that's true. It's just on the road. Yeah. I'm good. I had 16 years of that. I'm good.
Yeah.
I'll never go back to that. But I, you know, not to say anything bad about Oklahoma, there's a lot of really cool people there too. But
sure.
Just my experience of that overwhelming conservative Christianity was really hard.
Well, and those things can be really hard on mental health, because there is kind of an indoctrination that's put into you from a very young age of, you know, there's not a problem that can't be solved with prayer, you know, this is what we think, and you're part of we, so this is what you think. We all think this. This is how good people are. This is how bad people are.
Yeah.
And if you start finding yourself anywhere else on the spectrum of that, you start wondering, what is wrong with me?
Yeah.
Because I grew up pretty, you know, let's say my parents weirdly were kind of the more, let's say, left of center than the rest of the family.
Mm.
And they were conservative. So,
yeah.
So I was raised with, we were Lutherans instead of Catholic.
Oh, that's so like Catholic light, right?
Yeah, exactly. So it was like Catholic with no nuns.
Yeah. I kind of like nuns. They're kind of interesting. I love Catholic iconography.
But that's the thing. I mean, Catholicism and paganism actually work pretty well together.
Yeah, they do.
Because there's a lot of pomp and pageantry.
Yeah.
And, you know, all of that is... you know, kind of wonderful in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, if you could take the bullshit away from the Catholicism,
yeah,
it would be pretty interesting.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's kind of a long standing thing where it's beaten into you that there's all of these things, and you know, you don't talk about them because you'd be afraid to be ostracized for being different.
Yeah.
Even by your own family, your own family might go, whoa.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're not one of us.
Yeah. Yeah.
What?
Yeah. It was really hard.
Yeah.
It was very hard. I know I upset my mom a lot, but the great thing is, like, as an adult, we've come a long way, and she understands and accepts me for who I am. I think she thought it was a phase. You know, like me being more like alternative, and then that kind of turned into goth, and then I'm pagan and like very liberal and, you know, all of these things. And she's really come to accept me and love me, and that's brought a lot of healing.
Yeah.
And also being able to forgive my dad. So, but there's always work to do on, like, your childhood is so formative, you know, and you, when you grow up in a really abusive household where you're both being neglected and physically and emotionally abused.
Yeah.
The PTSD from that, I feel like, lives in your body, and you have to continue to deal with it. And just when I feel like I'm healed, like I've done all this work since I was 13 and I'm 35, you know, I feel like that's a long time to do a lot of work, but it's kind of a lifelong.
It is.
A lifelong thing.
That's the kicker, is learning that you're never done.
Yeah.
You know, isn't it interesting about that combo of neglect and abuse, and the way that it can trigger certain things in your personality? Mm-hmm. It's like you start craving approval from those people, because it's the only attention you're getting is the abuse.
And I lived like so. I think I've lived that out in relationships. Mm-hmm. Like, if I've been with someone who's really calm and doesn't fight, like, I want them to fight with me.
Yeah.
Which is really kind of sick. I'm working on that.
Yeah. Drama and passion are intertwined.
Yeah.
And it's like, I don't know how to take these two pieces apart.
I was like, why aren't you screaming at me? Why aren't you throwing things? What's wrong with you?
Right. Don't you love me?
Yeah. Exactly. It's really screwed up. But yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah. it's strange the things that shape you into an adult. You know, you can look at everything that you've been through and make decisions about where you are right now as a human being, and you can even tell yourself that it's not important where any of that trauma came from, but it kind of is. Mm-hmm. It's kind of important to understand where it came from so that you can start rewiring yourself not to repeat those patterns.
Exactly.
But that's a difficult process.
It is. And like you said, it's never done. Like,
yeah.
You can take medicine, but you still have to have the therapy. You know, like there is a chemical imbalance in my brain that I'm not necessarily responsible for. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just a biochemical response to trauma.
But now that you know that, you have a responsibility to it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I was really lucky because I had a lot of really amazing adults. Like, basically, I think the universe just sent these angels to me that were like, could pick up on the fact that I had a really bad home life and that I had a really abusive home life, because I never wanted to go home. Like, I became best friends with all my teachers. I joined every club. I was like straight A student, honor student, GT. In like basketball, cross country, band, student council president, honor society. Like, I joined any and every club. I ran a philosophy club. Like, any club I could get in or start, I would do so that I wouldn't have to go home. Because I never wanted to go home. And I think my teachers picked up on that. And there was one teacher in particular. Her name is Kim Pennington, and we all call her KP. I think I've told her this, but I don't think she realizes it to the extent that it really meant to me. Like, she would take my best friend at the time and myself to this place called Wild Care, where we would help wild animals that had been hurt. Mm-hmm. And it was in a town, it's in a town near Slaughterville, Oklahoma. you roll up to Slaughterville, Oklahoma, and it's like, welcome to, and then there's all these little words, and then in huge, giant red letters, hell. But it was like this sign about like anti-abortion.
Yes.
So it's like, welcome to Slaughterville. Welcome to hell. Yeah. But the cool thing was there was this amazing, like world-renowned wild animal refuge there. And I think she didn't have to do this.
Yeah.
It was on her own time. Every week she would drive us out there, and it was like a 30-minute drive, and keep us there for several hours and take care of these animals, and then she'd take us to dinner, and we would talk, and like, if I had not had someone like that, and then alongside my young adult librarian that I told you about.
Like, yeah.
Those two women really helped me get through my adolescence. And I had a lot of really, I had a lot of really great adults, like just so many teachers taking me under their wing.
That was
a
punctuation for your aha moment.
Yes. Ding. So that's what I feel like really inspired me to become an educator. Ding. Yeah. I felt like I had to pay it forward, you know? And I think because I was in middle school when KP came into my life and my young adult librarian came into my life, I felt like this major urge to teach middle schoolers.
Yeah.
So that's why I became a teacher, because I felt like I could really help other kids that were struggling like I did.
Yeah.
And it's been really cathartic and amazing and wonderful. But
there's a pretty big run-up to that point.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we get there? So you first discover that you need to talk to somebody when mm-hmm. you were like 12, 13.
Yeah.
What was it about that time period that let you know that you needed to talk to someone?
I was, you know, having a lot of thoughts about really like, I don't even know the word for it. Like very philosophical, deep thoughts about like, what is reality? What is this real? Is this a dream? And then if this is a dream, can I just turn it off and go somewhere else? And so I think that I was a little too smart for my own good at that age.
Yeah.
Because I was already like seriously getting into like a lot of like Lao Tzu and Nietzsche and like just trying to think deeper about reality.
Oh my God.
And so
Nietzsche's going to destroy you
yes,
at that age.
It was destruction. It's like adolescence and Nietzsche, kill me now. But literally I was starting to have these thoughts and I was starting to feel like a lot of hatred towards myself. And it was just really scary. Yeah. I wasn't quite at making a plan, you know, for suicide. And
sure.
I've learned since that once you have a suicidal ideation, your likelihood of having that suicidal, like having those thoughts, just it's part of who you are now and it's okay. And you're going to have those thoughts again and again.
Yes.
That was a big pill to swallow. So, but yeah, I started like, you know, really kind of having the urge to cut myself, but I didn't.
Yeah.
And I'm really lucky because I know a lot of people that have suffered with that. But I knew, like, I have to do something or something bad is going to really start happening.
Yeah.
So getting the therapist was really key. But it was a long conversation of convincing my mom that I needed to see a therapist. So I ended up cutting all my hair off. Like I did the late 90s like onion head look, like I just had long bangs and shaved head, and my mom freaked out. She's like, do you think you're a boy? And I was like, no, I'm obviously a girl. Like I mean nothing wrong with that, but I'm like, personally I'm, you know, I'm very cisgender, like I'm very female. And I was like, no, I just wanted to cut all my hair off. So I started making like impulsive decisions like most, you know, 13-year-olds do.
Right.
So then she finally was like, okay, I'm going to put you in therapy. So got to go to therapy.
Good and, wherever.
Yeah. Gosh. So that was good. I think that's when I started taking medication as well.
What was your first cocktail?
Celexa.
Celexa?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know that one.
Yeah.
Tell me about Celexa.
It was a good mood lifter. It was good because at first they diagnosed me with bipolar,
mm-hmm.
which was a misdiagnosis actually.
Yeah.
So they had me on Celexa for a long time, and it worked pretty well. But then as I got older and we moved to Colorado, and I feel like I had a better therapist here in Colorado. She was like, "You're definitely not bipolar."
Yeah.
I think that they just, like, at that time, were just slapping that label on everybody.
Right.
Like, in the early 2000s.
Yep.
So, I've been on, like, so many different medications. I think it was, like, Prozac, and I was on Prozac for a long time.
Yep.
And then Effexor, which was awful.
Mm-hmm.
Effexor was not helpful. And I was actually on Effexor when I actually did have to be hospitalized. So I think that one was a really bad one. I had to be hospitalized once. Mm-hmm. That was really hard.
Well, and what was that for?
So I had just had my daughter, and I was working with Johns Hopkins University in City Year and mm-hmm. a professor from Harvard to create a charter school for kids in Southwest Denver. And I basically think there were a combination of things. Like, I wasn't seeing a therapist. I was on a medication that wasn't working. My friend who was the principal who had been hired to help create this was fired. And then they hired someone who I felt like was very racist.
Stress levels were
crazy. Yeah. And I spent a year of my like blood, sweat, and tears creating this school for kids I really care about in a community I really care about. Southwest Denver is the highest poverty area of highest poverty in Denver.
Yeah.
1 in 10 of those kids graduate from high school. And so I was going door to door, sitting in people's living rooms, talking with them about the school we were going to create that was not only going to be academic, but also social emotional.
Yeah.
Because we know that kids in high poverty, poverty is trauma.
Yeah.
And so they're going to have a lot of mental health needs. And so that's why I was working so closely with people, folks from Johns Hopkins and Harvard. And I was synthesizing all of their white papers and all of their work. And it was a lot of work. I mean, these were like 60 to 80 hour weeks. I was traveling to Boston and Baltimore frequently.
Yeah.
And I had a little baby at home. And then they hired this woman. I won't say her name.
Right.
and she was calling the kids indigenous.
Ooh.
They were, you know, Hispanic migrant children.
Yeah.
Children, you know, from all over Latin America, but also Vietnam. And we also had Caucasian kids, like a vast variety of kids that lived in that neighborhood. And this kind of, she had like the, can I speak to your manager haircut? Mm. And she just kind of took all of the ideas that I had created in tandem with the people we were supposed to work with and pushed them all away. And it was just like, I freaked out.
Yeah.
Because it was just like, how dare you, first of all.
Right.
Like, and then she was talking about me behind my back, and it was just like all these horrible things, and just pushed me over the edge. It was too much, you know, just too many things. And I had a plan. I was going to go home and I was going to shoot myself in the head. Because I'm a gun owner, which is strange because I'm a liberal, but right. I love going shooting. It's a really good therapy. It gives you like an adrenaline rush that then gives you that calm.
There's actually a lot of liberal gun owners in Colorado.
Yeah.
A lot of them. It's, you know, it's something that surprises a lot of people.
Yeah. It's interesting.
Yeah.
I love shooting. It's I think it's really fun also just to hone that craft of being able to, you know, get that perfect shot. But, I had a plan. I was so scared because, you know, I have this little baby and I didn't want to leave her, but I felt like I'm just, you know, you get into those cognitive distortions and catastrophizing everything.
Right. And it's like, I'm going to be a disaster for this baby and mm-hmm. this baby will be better off without me.
Yeah. Like, obviously, the work that I do isn't good enough. I'm not good enough. And I personalized it and just let go of all the coping skills that I'd ever learned and just was in a really hot mess place. And I went to my doctor and I said, look, if I go home, like I called them and I said, I need to come in right now. And I said, if I go home right now, I'm not going to be alive.
Yeah.
And so they sent me, I always forget the name of it, but I went for 5 days and that was really helpful. They wanted to do the electronic, what is that called?
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
It's a newer thing, actually. Uh-huh. It's not something they've been doing for very long.
No.
Like as far as the history of this kind of
psychology.
Yeah, it's
not like where they
concerned.
Shock you with a thing in your mouth, like on the scary movies.
It's not electroshock therapy, but it is an electronic manipulation.
Yeah. Yeah. So I almost tried that, but I didn't.
Yeah.
We shifted my meds, and that made me feel a lot better. And I think also just
always the first thing to try, shift the meds. If you're on a bad med, it can really fuck you up.
Yeah. Effects are really fucked me up.
Yeah.
Like, have you ever heard that song, "The Shit Will Fuck You Up"? Like, it was like that. I was like, I am fucked up.
Yeah.
But it was really great. We did a lot of, like, art therapy. I got to have, like, quiet time. And
yeah.
And then I was like, all right. And then I felt empowered to quit my job. And then I taught at the Denver Women's Prison. And that was amazing.
Yeah.
After I had taught middle school for 7.5 years, and then I worked on that charter school for about 1.5 years, had the, like, moment of near-death experience. And then when I quit the job, I was like, what am I going to do? What can I do? And then I found that Department of Corrections was hiring, which I thought, this will be really weird.
Yeah.
Like, going into a prison was really scary the first time. I almost threw up at my interview, like, because I was so scared because I was in a prison.
Yeah.
Because I'd never been in a prison before.
It's like, if I say the wrong thing, they'll keep me.
Yeah. I probably should be in here with these people. No. But when I was working on the charter school, so many of those students' family members had been incarcerated.
Yeah.
And the trauma that left on their family. So anyway, I taught in the prison for a while. Loved it. Really loved it. But then I couldn't stay because the hours were so early and my daughter was going to be starting like this preschool that I just didn't have the childcare any longer for various reasons. So I was only able to stay there for 1 year. And then that's how I got into the job I'm in now, which is teaching students with severe emotional disabilities. So they are kids that typically outwardly express that through really negative behaviors in the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
So
I was one of those kids.
Were you?
Oh, yeah.
Aww.
Yeah, I ended up in a special school and everything.
Yeah, I teach at that special school.
There you go.
It's an amazing school.
Yeah. Honestly, it was really there that it was strange. In regular high school, I didn't do well. And the moment I went to the special school that I went to with all of the gang members and weirdos and all that, I was chill.
Yeah.
Because it was like, oh, okay, this is, they're seeing me and they're not judging me weirdly. I can be myself here and just do my schoolwork.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm so glad you had that.
Cool. Yeah. It was a weird experience for me because it was the first time I felt like none of the outward stuff mattered.
Yeah.
None of the mental illness stuff mattered. The teachers were like, yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm.
What else?
Yeah.
It's like, really? That's it?
What do you need?
Yeah. What do you need? We're going to try to get you to graduate high school. Yep. Like, that's what we can do. And then after you're out, if you ever need us, come talk.
Yep.
What?
I know. You can't do that in a traditional school. There's too many kids. Not at all.
I had a couple of good teachers, don't get me wrong. But I also had those experiences where, I was a weirdo. And so, like, I had one kid.
What? You were a weirdo?
Yeah, I know, right? Doing this coffee over suicide podcast. But I was in class once, and this one kid, he was probably abused. I mean, there was a lot going on with this dude, but he was a bully, and I was weird looking, so it was easy.
Mm-hmm.
And so he just decided one day, like, let's beat up this faggot. You know, that was the language was used. And my teacher came in the classroom, and he saw what was happening, and he shut the door and stood in front of it to watch.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Are you serious?
Yeah, seriously. And then the teacher told the kid, he was like, all right, sit down, leave the little faggot alone. And I'm like, okay, so this is how it's going to be.
Oh, my God.
All right. So I had those teachers, too.
Wow.
In the same day. You know,
those,
like,
people are
the teachers who were going to be helpful and then the teachers who weren't.
Yeah.
And it was just like, you know, okay, you have to learn to take people on a one-on-one basis.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until years later that I realized that, you know, man, there's a lot of damaged people out there that are going to really fuck you up if you let them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And kids, little kids are dealing with this.
Oh my gosh, they are.
Yeah.
Mental health among adolescents and even younger children is skyrocketing in our country right now.
Yes.
Also,
I think it's always been bad, but yes. It was just underreported before and the numbers are the same, because I don't necessarily believe that. I think it has been underreported.
Yes.
But I also think that it is growing.
Yeah.
Because we're in a sort of a strange transition period right now in history. Not just in this country, but in history, we are in a strange transition period as we start to come to grips with the gravity of the internet.
I agree.
And what it's doing to our species.
Yeah, it's like the next industrial revolution.
Yes.
Like the effect that the industrial revolution had on people. And I always think of like Mary Shelley's Frankenstein as like a symbol for that time.
Yes.
Like we are now in a time where the symbol of our time is zombies.
Yes.
Like we are in that place where we have no empathy and no human contact. Mm-hmm. And I actually had my students do like a 3-month project on that. How is the internet affecting us? Like,
yes.
I just posed this question to them. I had speakers come in, and then they had to put together presentations. And at first, they were all like, we don't want to do this, miss, because we love the internet, and blah, blah, blah. And then, like, they read all this stuff with me, how it affects your brain, like, even the dopamine uptake. And, like, and they were like, oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Like, and by and large, most of them, and by the end, was like they were like, "Yeah, I'm gonna take breaks from the internet. I'm gonna try
to learn how to use
play
this responsibly.
Outside and have friends in person, not just on, you know, Roblox or all the like games that they play. Like they feel like when they're playing those games, those are their friends, but they don't have like friends that they go out. Like kids don't play outside anymore,
right?
And it's heartbreaking. Like I was always outside until the lights went off, you know, or came on, excuse me, and then it was like, all right, I know, gotta go home because the street lights are on.
Yeah,
but like now kids are like barely ever outside,
right?
Because
they don't know how to interact with each other.
They
like,
don't.
You know, it's and you know, I can understand that too because you know, even as kind of a awkward, weird kid, I still had to go interact with other kids.
Yeah.
That's just how it happened.
Yeah.
If I was left to my own devices now, I wouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
I'd isolate.
Yeah.
I'd get safe contact, you know, safe harassment,
as
it were, you know, being cyber bullied versus physically bullied.
Yeah.
I'd take it. Not that it doesn't hurt.
I was going to say the cyberbullying, I think, is on par or worse with the physical bullying.
Yeah.
Cyberbullying leads to physical bullying.
It can get in your head, too. It can really change the way you see yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But the internet's a nuclear bomb, and we all have it.
Yep.
And none of us know exactly how it works.
And we're all zombie slaves to it, I feel like.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I'm even as guilty as
all
anyone.
All of us are.
Yeah.
Because the thing about it is this. It's an amazing tool. It's not just a force for evil.
Mm-hmm.
It's also a force for knowledge.
Yeah.
We can improve ourselves at the speed of light now, which was something that we couldn't do.
We can make podcasts.
Yeah. And we can also destroy ourselves at the speed of light. You know, with, you know, pornography and... Mm-hmm. You know, memes for hours and hours just fail compilations upon YouTube videos, upon everything, like right at your fingertips. It's like being locked in a room with, you know, all of the cakes and all the fast food. And it's but there's broccoli in there somewhere.
Yeah, there is. There's a lot of broccoli out there.
Yeah, but God damn it. It's like, it's all in front of you. It's
but
like,
I want the chocolate cake.
Yeah, exactly. But it creating a self-discipline of how you consume everything that you consume, including the things that you put into your head, the thoughts that you put into your head, the language that you use to describe the world you see around you and yourself, you adjust your reality. You create that reality and your expectation of that reality.
Mm-hmm.
Given what you're feeding yourself mentally, physically, emotionally, you do that to yourself, but you are only as good as what's being presented to you.
Mm-hmm.
So if your options are limited to what you're being fed, then you're going to come away with some damage. And yeah. I think a lot of people are.
Yeah, it's like the art imitates life, life imitates art.
Yeah.
Well, the internet has become that, like, instant art gallery that's, like, so entertaining and addictive.
Yeah.
And kids even talk like YouTubers. You know what I mean? Like, they even mimic to that point. And it's really scary. Because I felt like when I was a teenager or an adolescent, I had to figure it out on my own. Like, I had to go to the record store or go to Blockbuster or go to the movies or go to the thrift store and invent my own self.
Yeah.
Whereas these guys...
pick it off a shelf now.
Yeah, you don't... I mean, then there's no thinking through that. There's no originality.
Yeah.
And it's kind of scary.
I think that it's because of that, because there's so much available, that there's quite possibly an emphasis on success over failure,
more
so than maybe we dealt with.
Yeah,
the stakes were probably lower for us because you could get by with fucking something up and then learning from it, and nobody had ever really know about it. But now everything's online, and you know, all of your worst impulses. I mean, can you imagine if all of your journals went up online and were in existence? I looked back at some posts that I made just a few years ago, and the human being that I was just a few years ago, and it's like, oh, goddamn! Like thinking I was evolved even then, and,
right?
You know, and kids are going through that.
Yes.
Now, and it's
and being judged.
Yeah,
by
totally.
Everyone, even their parents, friends, like not just their peers, like everyone's judging them.
Yeah.
And it's interesting too, because I wanted to come back to like your idea of like slashing stigma with this podcast about mental health. Is it okay? You know, I'm always grappling with what's okay to share. Like if I'm in a really dark place, I hermit, but I might put something out there on Facebook.
Yeah.
Just so it's like a flag, like, hey, friends. But then I've had people tell me, I had someone actually tell me this weekend, hey, you don't need to share so much online.
Yeah.
Because I knew you were having a bad week, but you're making yourself way too visible with your mental health by putting all that out there. But then I'm like, how are we ever going to slash a stigma? How are we going to let people know that it's okay to talk about it?
Yeah.
If we, he also struggles with a lot of mental illness. And I'm just thinking, like, how can we slash that stigma if we're not able to talk about it?
Yeah.
Even in a public forum.
It's definitely a real mixed bag.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's because I have that tendency too. I definitely hermit.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, do I hermit?
Yeah.
You know, and putting things out there, I have gotten maybe more selective about it. Or, you know, I definitely want to share an honest thought as it comes in. I don't delete anything anymore. I don't delete posts if I'm embarrassed of them or anything like that. I don't do it anymore. I used to.
That's awesome.
But, you know, what that is a failure to be honest. You know, if you're deleting old stuff because it makes you look dumb or bad, it's like, I was dumb and bad.
Yeah. And, I'm a human being.
Yeah, yeah. And I did this dumb thing and I'm embarrassed of it and I'm ashamed of it. But there it is. It exists. I mean, you know, anything that you've ever put on the internet is available somewhere anyway.
Yeah.
It is difficult now to figure out how to go where I'm going to go publicly. So I just do it here.
Yeah.
You know, and I've talked about everything and, you know, I got kids and so I've had to tell them I'm going to go public with some stuff. So there've been a couple of episodes where I went public with some things that honestly I wasn't really prepared for.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to talk to people about it. Like I had to talk to my wife and my kids and be like, hey, so just had a conversation with somebody in the studio and, talked about being sexually assaulted. So that's going to be out in the world.
Yeah.
That's everybody hard. Okay with that? because it's not just me.
No.
You know, I'm representing, I guess I'm not really representing them. But they're like, you're willing to talk about that? Okay. So they've been really supportive.
Yeah.
But at the same time, that was a tough thing for me to grapple with, mm-hmm. was how much do you share? How much is too much?
Right.
And so whenever I'm having a conversation like the one I'm having with you, I just kind of let it go wherever it's going to go. And, you know, whatever we're comfortable with in the moment.
Yeah.
And just seeing where it happens. And I think that's how the conversations need to be.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't overthink it and you're comfortable enough to say it, say it.
Yeah.
And everyone should feel free enough to be able to do that. But also, there should be resources for people. If you say something and then you think about it later and you're like, that was kind of boneheaded, or I was wrong about this, or I can't believe I used to feel this way. I was upset about the world in such a way that was, you know, I was wrong about this. Mm-hmm. My general feeling was right. I can own my sadness, but where it came from, you know, I was wrong about this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things about like that. Like, we have to allow people to grow and change and go through something and, you know, see if they're going to be able to come out the other side and let them know you're allowed to get this wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You're just not allowed to quit trying.
Right. Yeah. The quit trying is like a big thing.
Yeah. And suicidal ideation is a tough one to live through.
It is.
It's a really tough one to live through. So, I mean, with your experience with that, do you still have that? Is that just part of how things are?
Yeah. Unfortunately, I had suicidal ideations this week.
Yeah.
I think it's just kind of, once you've had that thought, like I was saying, you know, it lives there in your brain, and it's okay if you can remember emotions are real, but they're not reality.
Yes.
And that's something I have to say to myself all the time. Like, okay, this is a real feeling I'm having right now because I'm going through some tough things in my personal life.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm actually going through a divorce.
Mm-hmm.
I was dating someone and that didn't work out, and I'm going through, like, is it okay for me to be alone and work on myself?
Yeah.
Do I really want to open up those boxes, those Pandora boxes again?
Yeah.
And now it's even heavier and bigger. And so sometimes I think almost the suicidal ideation is almost like escapism,
mm-hmm.
because it's like, well, I'm freaking tired of this life being so hard.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think people that are overly reflective, or not overly, but super reflective and in their mind, and thinkers and artists, I think we all kind of suffer.
Yeah.
I've never met an artist or a musician or a thinker that doesn't suffer internally.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I feel like it's just part of, unfortunately, you know, ignorance is bliss. But if you're like a deep thinker and you read a lot and you think a lot about, you know, the world and what is reality, like I was saying, like I've had those thoughts since I was really young.
Yeah.
But I will say that I did want to talk about music a little bit.
For sure.
Yeah. Because I think music for me, like I have no depth perception, so I can't draw. I don't like no visual skills. It's really bad. But I've always thought in song, and I've always found that to be the most therapeutic thing for me. Like,
when did you first discover that?
I think when I was really little, I was like 3.
Uh-huh.
And my dad tells me stories, and my mom too, about how I would just go out on the swing set and I would just be out there singing, writing songs.
Yeah.
Like, coming up with songs, and then I would be like, all right, now I'm going to perform my songs for everyone. Everybody sit down. And I would sing these like crazy songs.
Yeah, the look at me disease from
way
back.
I did. Like, please validate my creations now.
Yeah.
But then I started playing piano at a very young age. My mom put me in piano lessons when I was about like 7.
Wonderful.
Yeah. And then at 12, she bought me a guitar. And that was like, that was the best thing ever.
Yeah.
I still have that guitar, and it's still my favorite guitar to play. It's just like a cheap Yamaha that she got at like Sam's Club, I think.
Oh, yeah.
It's like a $99 special.
Yep.
And that thing's been through so much with me. And so I began writing songs I think like my songwriting like officially started about that time at the age of 12.
Yeah.
As soon as I could write, I started writing poetry. And so just being able to write songs, and I was in band and played flute, and that was really fun as well. But being able to write those songs, like I still know how to play and have the lyrics to songs that I wrote about dealing with abuse of my father and wanting to be a bird and fly away, not to sound like Forrest Gump, but like that's, you know, and dealing with my mental health. And those are some pretty dark songs and really serious songs.
Yeah.
And then I had a really good friend that introduced me to Switchblade Symphony, which is a goth band.
Yeah,
they're amazing. I wish they were still together so badly. But and then I got a taste of that, oh my God, there's musicians that write dark music. Like, what is this? And like the whole world opened up. And then as I got older and I met my first husband, like he introduced me to Skinny Puppy and Ministry and down the rabbit hole I went.
Classics.
Yeah. Down the rabbit hole I went. And then I discovered there's a huge scene here in Denver. Like Denver has one of the best goth scenes, I feel like, that I've found here in the States, you know, that it's amazing. Like, it's so loving. People accept you. I mean, there's always the, like, kind of weirdness that is being goth. There's always the awkwardness because I think we're all very awkward. But it's just really beautiful. And so I've had a couple of goth industrial bands that I've been a part of. But I've always worked with very controlling men. And so I didn't get as much say, and I was just kind of like relegated to like, you know, delegated to like, you go play the keyboards over there quietly and then we'll sing when we tell you to sing. And, or I need you to play really fast guitar and be like the hot chick on the side that plays the fast guitar.
Right.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay. But then I met my current, partner, Mikey. He is a partner in crime and music, I should say.
Yeah.
He's a drummer, but he's also a multi-instrumentalist and one of the best songwriters I've ever met, but also one of the most kind and accepting human beings.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he never bosses me around. He's so kind. And when I'm having, like, such despair and depression or anxiety from whatever, and I just tell him, hey man, I can't do it right now. Like, I'm too depressed. He understands. He doesn't think that I'm like flaking out on him. Like, he gets it. And that's huge for me. And the fact that he let me create our current album the way that he let me do it. And I say let me because I'm so used to men that are controlling the goth industrial scene.
Well, and also if you're a part of you know, a musical collaboration, there is a lot of give and take.
Yes.
And, you know, especially when people have ideas.
Yes.
Everybody's got ideas.
Yeah.
So to allow someone to take the reins and say, I've got lead on this.
Yeah.
That's, you know, that's not nothing. There's a lot of trust that goes into that.
Yeah. And he did. And it was really amazing. I have a song that we wrote on our album called Gravity that's about when I almost killed myself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, yeah, and those things are necessary. You know, it's strange. When I was growing up and I was going through all this stuff, you know, poetry and songwriting was my savior. That was my everything.
Yes.
And my folks didn't get it. And I didn't know how to articulate it other than to say, this makes me feel better to get this out.
Yeah, it's like pulling splinters out.
Yeah. And, you know, I could look at those things and go, I survived this.
Yeah.
You know, I survived myself.
Crisp high five.
But I heard someone else articulate it beautifully. I don't remember who it was, but they looked at me and they were like, yeah, it's the blues. That's what it is. That's why the blues has endured for people. And it just, that clicked for me. It was like, oh yeah, it's a celebration of life. It's not about death. I mean, it's about, you know, a living person's struggle with life.
Yeah. And I think just it made me think about, like, the goth scene.
Yeah.
I was talking with my friend Dylan, who's freaking amazing. He's an amazing artist and DJ. And we were laughing because we were talking about how people think goths are so morbid and sad. But right. actually, we're, like, really happy people. Like,
right.
We're actually sad. So you can't have light without darkness, right? So, like, we're in the darkness, but, like, within that darkness, there is light. And
but there's also
fun.
Beauty in that darkness.
Yeah, there is a lot of beauty
yeah.
in the darkness. And embracing that and being okay with that has been a journey for me.
Yeah.
Why have I always been attracted to, you know, darkness or felt like I'm not in the right era, like I'm
yeah.
not alive at the right time or something?
Yep. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so like being
okay with
that. A
lot of people feel that way. And finding yeah. your community is important.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, there's a lot of things that do bind us together as a human race, but
yeah.
there are certainly things that bind us together as smaller pockets within our own communities,
mm-hmm.
and that's okay.
Yeah, it is. It's
yeah.
great. And I think, you know, once I was able to embrace that, like, I love making this kind of, you know, dark electronic music, and I love being able to express, you know, what's on my heart. Because my first inclination with our album was to go political.
Yeah.
And Mikey was like, I want you to go deeper. Like, everybody's doing that political thing.
Yeah.
You
go,
know? Like,
go deeper.
And he gave me permission with that to say, okay, let's, and we both agreed, this album and all of our albums really are going to be about the struggle of the human heart, the struggle of the human psyche. And so that's what I've really tried to do there, because I'm a very politically active person too. And so it was hard
yeah.
for me at first, because I was like, but I want to write a song about Trump. But no,
yeah.
it's so much more lasting and more important to dig deeper than that.
Right.
Trump is just a manifestation of our collective sadness as a world right
this
now.
This is a blip on the timeline.
Right.
Whereas what you...
There's
what,
much deeper.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it would make more sense to write about the feelings that are coming from it, because,
mm-hmm.
you know, not to be pessimistic, but, you know, even after this guy's gone, it's coming back at some point.
Oh, yeah.
The pendulum always swings.
That's right.
But we are in a particularly tricky time where
mm-hmm.
I think that this was just, you know, this was just a symptom of the fact that everyone is feeling a culturally collective, I don't know what the fuck to do right now.
Yeah.
And like my best friend voted for Trump.
Wow. Yeah.
Regrets it,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, not super savvy with the internet and
mm-hmm.
knowing how things work, and just kind of like, yeah, I don't know. I don't know. It's
yeah.
like, well, okay. And my parents did. Of course, my parents were like, you know, we know what we're doing. And
yeah.
I was like, oh, you guys.
Yeah.
You're
my dad
me here.
Did, and a lot of my friends back home in Oklahoma
yeah.
did. And I'm just like, wait, how is this a thing? But
it's tough to find. It's tough to tap in to that deep empathy.
Mm-hmm.
For people when you feel like, yeah, but you enabled a monster.
Yeah.
It's tough, but with certain people, it is necessary to be able to go, I'm not gonna forgive that or agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm gonna acknowledge that.
Yeah.
You did that, and that's where your heart and your head is for some weird reason. And you know, we're gonna talk about other things. We're gonna be other places. You know, I have a decent relationship with my parents. Really, nobody else in my family, but I have a decent relationship with my parents, and
that's good.
Kind of like it to stay that way.
Yeah.
So
totally,
I let them know where I stand on things. I let them know what I thought about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as respectful as I could.
Yeah.
And that was the end of it.
Yeah. It's okay to let it go.
It is, yeah.
Let
and with
go.
My best friend, too.
Just kidding.
You know? I mean, he's my best friend in the
yeah.
world. He's
yeah.
he's the family I chose. You know,
yep.
I love this guy. And it's like, yeah, I can recognize it
mm-hmm.
without agreeing with it.
Yeah.
But I know all of the other things about you that make you a worthwhile human being. And while
mm-hmm.
we can disagree on this, okay. Yeah, we can disagree and still have a life and be friends and do things. And it's hard to have such open empathy that you're willing to kind of take people as they are, mm-hmm. rather than take people as their choices. It's a daily struggle of yeah. knowing where the line is of, you know, where you cut somebody off.
Yeah.
It's a daily struggle because you meet people, you hear things about people, you know what you know about people from the internet, you know, but you don't know everything. Yeah. It's a difficult time to handle those things and navigate them like with any sort of real clarity. It's a yeah. lot easier to just go fuck yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think like my career has really evolved while I've been teaching these students with the social emotional disabilities.
Sure.
Has really, really, one, made me deal with my own shit on a much deeper level, but two, helped me understand why people act the way they act. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I get cussed out. I get things thrown at me. You know, I have kids getting fights. I mean, there are days where I go ugly cry in the corner because I'm dealing with so much heavy stuff.
Yeah.
But then they'll come back the next day and apologize and tell me why they were feeling that way. And usually it's this really gut-wrenching story about something they had to endure the night before. And you never know what someone's going through. You know, like, I even think about people who are bigots and racists and, like, Nazis. Like,
yeah.
every ounce of my body hates that.
Yeah.
You know, or people who are homophobic. Like, I'm so against that.
Yeah.
But then if I take a step back, like you were talking about, having that, like, major empathy, I can realize, like, there's a lot going on for them. Something's going on for them. I have no idea.
You got that way through damage.
Yeah. Yeah. Like.
Yeah.
And I feel like no human should be given up on. And yeah. and that's, you know, I learned that from working in corrections.
It's a tough one though.
Yeah, and working with my students.
So how do you go through with that high level of empathy without your heart just weighing you down?
It's hard. And that is something that I have been working very, very hard on with my therapist.
Yeah.
It's a lot of one imagery that I create for myself every morning as like my morning routine is I put a bubble around myself and I pretend like there's little dials in front of myself and I can choose when I can make that bubble out of steel, mm-hmm. right? Like I need to help myself not take in anything, or I can make that bubble out of, you know, something very thin. But I shield myself with a bubble and, you know, I try to emit love and caring, but I also have to love myself and I have to balance it. I can't take anything personally. That's been a huge learning lesson for me because I, as an empath and as somebody who struggles with mental health, I tend to personalize a lot. And so yeah. you can't personalize, right? You have to see past the mask and see past the personalization. That's my phone. I'm sorry. And so if you can do that, if you can get past thinking that this person's cussing me out right now because it's my fault, I'm a terrible teacher, I'm a horrible person. No, they're yeah. cussing me out because they didn't have dinner last night. They live in like a nasty, terrible trailer mm-hmm. where they don't even have hot water.
Yeah.
And their parents are on drugs and they're yeah. at school today and they hate the world.
Right.
And the fact that they showed up shows me that they care enough about themselves and this program. You know what I mean? Like you just yeah. have to get past, it's not personal. Yeah. And I even think about like people who were neo-Nazis and then they like turn around and change.
Yeah.
People can grow and change. Like you yeah. can never give up on someone.
I saw that happen. Yeah. I witnessed it happen.
That's awesome.
I was on a cross-country trip. I was going to Los Angeles for a thing back when I was living in Michigan. So I'm on a Greyhound because it was the cheapest way to get there.
Yeah.
And
that's a lot.
So, oh, yeah.
It's a long trip.
Yeah, 3 days. But we picked up a couple of Nazi guys in Albuquerque, like you do.
Yeah.
And they sat separately. One of them was sitting next to a black preacher. Like, it was the weirdest
That's
thing.
Awesome.
And then over the course of the trip, because I got to sit, you know, just over so that I could hear them and watch them talk. And they were talking to each other. And he was talking to him, and he was like, you know, I've been struggling with some things, and I'm actually going out to, to see some family, to get out of this lifestyle. I'm getting out of this, and my friend is coming with me. He's like, oh, you're both getting out? He's like, no, he's staying in, but he's coming with me to make sure I get there okay. It's like, fuck. So the one guy's staying a Nazi, but he's taking his I don't want to be a Nazi anymore friend back to his family in California.
And think about the ripple effect of that.
Yeah.
I bet the friend that wasn't going to get out.
Yeah.
Might have had more thinking and more thoughts about that. And
I watched that Nazi and that preacher hug at the end of the trip, and that was like mind blowing. I'd like that was the greatest thing ever. Like,
that's amazing.
Yeah, you know, I hadn't even thought about that in years because that was a long time ago. It was,
yeah,
you know, 20 years ago maybe. Holy shit, it was 20 years ago.
Wow, yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, but that was something that I witnessed.
Yeah,
I think getting out in the world, to kind of go backward around to a point that we had discussed earlier, I think that's something that you're missing by simply seeing everything on the internet.
Yeah.
When you go out into the world,
mm-hmm.
interactions are a lot more complicated, but they're a lot more rewarding when you actually can see and experience things for yourself.
Exactly.
It's like visiting the Grand Canyon. You seeing a picture of it doesn't work.
Yeah.
It doesn't work. And that's like life. Seeing a picture of life does not work.
Yeah. And I think, a lot of people kind of really cautioned me when I went into this field of special ed.
Yeah.
Like, are you crazy? You want to teach the hardest, hardcore kids of the district? The kids that should be in corrections and the kids that everybody else has given up on. And the reward that I get from that is a millionfold. And I loved the kids I worked with in the mainstream school, but to see someone grow, like you're talking about the Nazi talking to a black priest, to see a kid who was cutting themselves and telling me, fuck you, fuck off, fuck the world, and I'm not going to do your stupid shit and fuck off, like all day long for months, you know what I mean? To then come around, and I had this student this year who, he is so beautiful, and he finally came around, and he designed an anti-bullying t-shirt and created a whole speech and a presentation to give to the school about anti-bullying. And he was an angry, angry bully kid.
Yeah.
To turn around and then he created this t-shirt that had a phoenix on it that had all these words about love and peace and understanding.
Yes. And the symbolism is strong, rising from your own ashes.
And he talked about that so deeply. And I'm like, dude, this is why I'm here. Like, these kids are my tribe. I feel so much for them, but I still have to keep that barrier, and I still have to keep, from personalizing, and not steal their struggle. Like, let them have their struggle.
Yeah.
And know that it's going to be okay. I'm not going to leave. I'm not going to change. You know what I mean? And I think if more people could be like that in the world, not that I'm like some... I'm definitely not perfect and I struggle a lot. But I think if like you were saying, if we could sort of see the world in a place where we don't give up on people, even Trump.
Yeah.
As much as I really don't like him.
Yeah.
A lot. Like I scream at the TV and don't like him a lot.
Oh, yeah.
He's still a human with a heart and a soul, and I know a lot of people don't believe that, but there could be something really decent in him, and even he could be swayed.
Yeah. That's the thing. It's like even a monster like that probably has moments where he's made his children laugh.
Yeah.
Had some sort of moment where he reached someone and made their life better. You know?
Maybe he's struggling. Maybe secretly
he's... definitely struggling.
Maybe he's really suffering. I mean, maybe his dad was abusive to him.
I would believe that.
He's got a lot of pain, and he doesn't have the right people around him to help him through it.
Yeah.
So I think that's a huge thing, too, is to have a circle, a support group, a circle of safe people around you, too, which has been something that's been really helpful. Again, in the goth community, I've just got a really good group of friends that have helped me a lot.
Well, all of that is really inspiring and really amazing, and I'm so glad that you're out there doing it.
Thank you.
Thanks for talking to me.
Yeah, and thank you for doing this podcast. It's awesome.
And that's the conversation. I've been so lucky to have such amazing, brilliant, wonderful, verbose people on this show. And I can find no better way to celebrate 1 year in than talking to somebody who is all of that. If you want to check out more of the Midnight Marionettes, and I know you do, go to themidnightmarionettes.com. You can also check them out live July 12th at Moe's in Englewood, Colorado for the Sharon Tour kickoff. You can find events in the feed below. And as for me, I will be back next week with an answer for what the hell happened July 4th. But until then, don't kill yourselves out there.